previously.tv podcast network.
From the Previously.tv network of earbud excellence, this is The Blotter Presents, your one-stop pod shop for the best and worst of TV true crime, present day, and yesteryear. Hands on the wall, it's episode 2. Theme song may actually be worse than jazz. I haven't decided yet. I'm your desk sergeant, Sarah D. Bunting, and this week I am here with Eve Beatty. Hello, Eve. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Today, in our Most Wanted section, we're going to be discussing a little show from Spike, but first, the cue. From Spike comes Time, the Khalif Browder story, which is sort of an unwieldy title for this property, but I was really pleasantly surprised at how good it is. For those of you not familiar with Khalif Browder, he was arrested at age 16 in New York City, suspected of robbery, stealing a backpack. Apparently he had he was on probation for allegedly having stolen a bread truck. That arrest was a violation of his probation, so for various cocked up reasons, he spent 3 years on New York's notorious Rikers Island, nearly two of those in solitary, for want of $900 bond. He was eventually released, but took his own life a couple of years after his release. Spike is airing a 6-part documentary called Time, the Khalif Browder Story, which is about the systemic problems, capital P problems, that led to this Donnybrook. I first read about this because Variety's Mo Ryan reviewed it and was very impressed with it. I was kind of feeling like it was going to be one of those homeworky documentaries that, like, this, you know, this is an important issue. But I do read The New Yorker. I do read New York Magazine. I did feel like I knew what was up with this story. What I wasn't prepared for is the incredible access that this documentary gets to everyone. Browder's family, Van Jones, Al Sharpton. I mean, whatever. Al Sharpton would go to the opening of an envelope, but still, he's a, you know, smart guy. I thought it was really good. I was really disappointed that the episodes that were available ended and then I had to wait for another one. Do you think it was good?
I did. I think that I can only assume that some of the access was the wheels were greased by the presence of Jay-Z as a producer.
Sure.
Because I think, and that's the thing too, is because the first time that Jay-Z spoke when we were watching the show, I thought, well, why is he even talking? You know, he wasn't there. And then I thought, because Jay-Z is interesting. And because, you know, you're looking at him and you're just thinking about everything. You think about Lemonade, right? You're thinking about all that. And, you know, and he, I mean, not that he doesn't have the relevant life experience, but I'm certain that having him there opened a lot of doors that wouldn't have been opened otherwise. I really liked how they're framing it, at least in the episodes that we've seen thus far, how they're framing it as part of the deposition and sort of taking it through us through it that way. We're hearing him give this deposition, which I don't know if this is actually a recording of it or sort of a reconstruction or what, but
yeah, that is a little confusing. That is probably my one complaint,
because, you know, you saw, you know, the back of the character sort of walk in and you know, see people who are obviously actors, you know, to sort of set up, oh, he's at a deposition. But that is, I think, one of the things that kept it from feeling homeworky, is that, you know, pulling it out sort of that way is an interesting way to sort of unwind the narrative.
Yeah. And it also does, it can be a little like tricksy film school, like the cutting between the like tapping foot and the fidgeting fingers. And it was a little distracting to me that one of the voice actors who is playing one of the lawyers in the deposition sounds like Sandy Duncan.
Well, and just, she looks like that actress from Sports Night, the woman who worked in the production booth, whose name I should have looked up before I mentioned that too. So I thought it was her for a second.
Oh, Felicity Huffman? Oh, yeah.
No. The sort of the junior woman who ended up sort of dating Josh Molina during the show.
Oh, yeah. Sabrina, you know what I'm something. About. Yes, yeah. I totally do. Natalie on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be a little distracting, but sometimes I find, you know, when you watch enough true crime programming, like you're grateful for like sometimes a little break, especially given this topic and the access that they also had to Browder's fellow inmates, present and former, and to footage of Browder suffering these beatdowns, COs doing nothing. There were a couple of sort of B-roll type things where they're talking about prison conditions where you see someone being taken out of a cell and the floor is just a lake of blood and there's feces on the windows and you just absolutely can't believe that this is the situation. So sometimes to have that little, like, I don't know, somewhat pretentious like reenactment stuff going on gives you a little bit of a break from the kind of unrelenting bleakness when they're talking about the system in Rikers. I also learned a lot about, you know, Riker, for whom the island is named, and that whole system. But let's listen to Bernard Carrick, who himself is for some reason out of jail right now, talking a little bit about the, quote, predatory population at Rikers Island.
Rikers Island has a predatory population. They're usually the younger inmates. Those inmates fight, stab, slash. They light people on fire when they're sleeping.
Animal lesson. That's what the COs call it. That's what we call it. It's animal lesson. It's just like animals. Like, that's what they call us, animals.
Oh, he's an animal. Oh, he's a menace to society because he fought police, because he slashed somebody. That's not how you should look at me. I'm in a negative environment. And this is how I survive.
Do you have, you write a lot about local crime in San Francisco. Is there sort of an analogous systemic?
There absolutely
systemic?
Is. It's not like this, I don't believe. It's not to this extent, but in recent years, we've certainly had our fair share of scandals at San Francisco County Jail. San Francisco County Jail is sort of divided up into sort of three locations too, which I suspect sort of helps keep things from, you know, like when we were hearing about sort of the gang activities and sort of the grouping activities, I think it makes it easier to break things up when you actually have three different physical locations. San Francisco County Jail, the main one, is not in great physical condition. It's the building itself is very problematic, and if we have another big earthquake, it's going to be really bad. But in addition to that, there have been problems with the – we don't have COs at our county jail. It's all run by the sheriff's department. So a few years ago in the San Francisco County Jail, some inmates came forward and made people aware that some of the sheriff's deputies that were in charge of the main county jail were arranging fight clubs. You didn't have a choice. You had to fight if you were
– No, just like Rikers.
Yeah, and,
great.
But as opposed to – you know, sort of the practical application, it seems like the COs at Rikers were using, oh, we'll have you beat guys up to, you know, follow our will. This was way dumber. This was just like, we're going to, this was more like Mandingo fighting. They were, betting on who would win. So it's, you know, even grosser in a certain extent that it was just like, you know, oh, well, we're going to bet on which guy is going to, you know, beat the shit out of some other guy. And, you know, there are definitely some strong questions raised about corruption. A pretty big time guy, member of a cartel who was in county, who shouldn't have been able to run around and do things, somehow ended up on garbage detail and evaded, I'm doing big air quotes here, the one sheriff's deputy who was watching him. It doesn't help that our county jail is right by the intersection of multiple freeways. So when you get out of, if you somehow manage to get out of county, you're in pretty good shape if you're smart in terms of an escapee. I do think that, you know, as opposed to with Rikers, where there are so many levels of management, that before, you know, they were talking about how the reformers are so far from anybody who's actually got boots on the ground. Here, I think there are fewer sort of levels. So, you know, things are a little bit easier, but still, I mean, show me a county jail. That's good, though. Think about, you know, when we were, you know, watching 60 Days In, you and I, how problematic and corrupt that very, very small town jail was.
Yeah. And this one did not have the, that one, I assume, did not have the same sort of stranglehold on politicians and sort of roadblocking any kind of meaningful change as the COBA's head does here. Let's listen to another clip.
Weird in there. Like, what's right to them isn't right, and what's wrong isn't wrong.
Khalif had this spirit of someone who stood up for themselves in the face of whatever the odds were.
I was the type of person, I stood up for what was right, even when I was in jail.
He had that no filter type of personality, and he would tell you, listen, let me tell you something, I'm gonna tell you how it is.
Khalif will talk. He was a talker. If he felt things weren't right, he would speak up on it. And they didn't like that too much.
If he's just a mouthy inmate, of course he's gonna get mistreated.
Yeah, I love that they cut from his mom sort of joking around fondly about how her son would just like let you know to a former CO. And they have a lot of former COs, some of whom I get the feeling are in jail themselves right now for bringing shivs into the jail to sell, because that seems like a great idea. But I, that was, again, another place where I was very impressed by the show's access. And I was also impressed by how quickly the show is willing to go straight from this, you know, bereaved mom who has had like two heart attacks from grief and stress to the CO who's like, well, you know, if he's lippy, of course he's going to get beat on. Like, wow. I mean, sure, those are both points of view, but it's a little unusual, I think, in nonfiction crime programming to go like be that fluid between the points of view. Were you struck by that?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear that the show has an agenda. And, you know, it's not coming at it from a, well, let's see both sides about what it's like to be in jail. And so, and I feel like shows like Making a Murderer have paved the way for that. Like, you don't have to pretend to be objective, even if you have an opinion anymore, because look at how well that show did. And I don't know, you know, even like more so than like, you know, Serial or something. So I sort of, I thought that some of that stuff was almost intentionally jarring, or, you know, sort of their version of, you know, ironic juxtaposition. Like, they wanted to make us feel it.
Right. What did you think of having us watch one of Browder's assaulters watch the, like, one of the many melees in which Browder was involved? Did you think that was manipulative or effective?
I thought it was fascinating because, watch, it was like, it was like watching someone who's skilled at a profession watching, you know, like watching game tapes or something like that, or, you know, watching like hidden camera.
Yeah,
you know, if you're a bartender,
you're right,
and you're watching like hidden camera of another bartender or something like that. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And so to me, it's like being able to see it through his eyes and watch him watch it made me understand it in a way that I just see like a bunch of guys running around and it looks really scary.
Yeah. And you can't necessarily tell.
Like, he's like, okay, so those guys shouldn't be there and stuff like that, you know? So, yeah.
And where's the CO and why isn't that door working? Yeah. And then you also have, like, some prison reform advocates watching it. But I thought that was very interesting. And I also thought it was noteworthy, like, just how much of the tape they would let run. Because I think we're pretty used to just seeing the same snippet as the, like, ad break outro.
Yeah.
Like, the way these shows tend to be built, and this is a little different. So, yeah, it was pretty striking. So, are you going to keep watching this?
Yeah, I think I am. I'm, I'm sort of glad you brought it up because, like, Spike is not a show that I necessarily think about watching, you know, just when I'm at home or, you know, like, whatever. Like, on the rare occasion that I'm actually still in the position to be flipping around on TV, Spike is very rarely where I end up, especially once they lost American Ninja Warrior and it went over to Esquire. That sort of took away any reason I had to watch it. So I think it's kind of heartening and really interesting that they are the people who ended up with this show as opposed to, you know, probably the many other people who are looking at it now thinking, damn it, I wish we had it. And I'm hopeful that that indicates maybe a rethinking and direction of this, of that little network.
Yeah, they do seem to be in this place where they're like in between identities, like sort of how Oxygen is transitioning from, like, I don't know, reality shows about former Flavor Flav lady friends getting drunk and beating each other up to a, like, completely and overtly criminal versus, like, culturally criminal set of programs. I'm not sure where in that transition process they are, although they did say that it would be this month, March of 2017. But this, I don't know, it's funny that in the last, I'm going to say 12 to 18 months, that getting a, like, the get of a prestige true crime series like this is what starts to put networks or, like, stations that are trying to redefine themselves. That's what turns the ship.
Yeah.
So that's sort of weird.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, PBS is wise to sort of look at this and think what they should be doing next, or they're going to be left in the dust with just, you know, old baking shows. And I mean, Sherlock's never coming back. Let's face it, guys. So they're going to have to figure this out. But I mean, you know, this is something that at one time we would have expected to see on PBS in the same way we would have expected The Jinx or Making a Murderer to perhaps be on PBS, as, you know, they were once the standard holders for, you know, great documentary work. So seeing that it's, you know, now being spread beyond, you know, the tote bag crowd, to me is really exciting too.
Yeah. Well, and that, as I mentioned on Extra Hot Great recently, American Experience has always been really fascinating, like, in terms of making nonfiction documentary films, mostly about historical events, but then it can verge on crimes. They've done one on Leopold and Loeb. Mm-hmm. They did one on Triangle Shirtwaist. Two recent ones about Oklahoma City and Ruby Ridge were extremely good and harsh. And that's, I think PBS needs to keep, you know, stay on that current programming. Otherwise, you're absolutely right. Netflix, Spike, all these people are just going to eat their lunch, and the government will not be providing a hot.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, they can't count on that for the next 2 years.
Yeah, and my loyal $10 a month to WNET Channel 13 is probably not going to help. I'm there for you though, Sesame Street. God, even that moved, right?
Right, isn't it? Yeah, I know. I think it's on, like, HBO or something.
I know. Jeez, what a message for today's youth. Well, Kalief Browder is one of those. It's not like a New York only crime, but it is sort of like germane just to this city. For our next section, I asked Eve to think about a San Francisco crime that might have been covered on TV. That's what we'll be talking about in Cold Case. Eve, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about what is known sort of generically as the San Francisco dog mauling case, which to me is pretty vague because, you know, dogs maul people all the time. That's no big deal. But this story is interesting because it's not just the case of a big dog that was uncontrolled and fatally injured someone. It turns out to be a case of much, much more. And this is a case that had everybody in San Francisco, even me. I can't even tell you what a loser I was in 2001. Like, I was on dial-up, living in the hate, completely unemployed, just waiting for the Buffy block to come on FX in the morning. I had nothing going on. And, you know, suddenly this horrible thing happened on January 26th, 2001. This woman named Diane Whipple, who was entering her apartment building, was fatally mauled by her married neighbor's two dogs that are both Presa Canarios. These aren't pit bulls. These are purebred, really huge dogs that you probably haven't seen because in a lot of places they're banned. So she was attacked by these dogs, died in the hospital a short time later due to a massive loss of blood, and very quickly information started coming out about the dog's guardians that made this a case that was splashed across all of the papers. And after a while...
Yeah, before we get into the multifarious complications of this case, let's hear a quick clip from American Justice, narrated, of course, by Bill Curtis, who seems to keep coming up on this podcast. Bless his heart, about what the police were walking into after they got the 911 call.
For police, it had all started at 4 p.m. that afternoon with a desperate 911 call.
911, we have two dogs rampaging out in the hall up on the sixth floor, and I think they have even their owner cannot control them. They are huge. Please hurry. I hear screaming, and I don't dare open the door. These dogs are ferocious.
Soon after, police arrived on the scene and entered the building. Uncertain where the dogs were, the officers proceeded cautiously.
Be advised, we're going to, fire as soon as we see it.
Yikes.
Well, and it's worth noting, too, that this one of the reasons, of course, with every crime, there are a couple of reasons that this made it even sort of a bigger deal than a kid getting mauled by a pit bull in the projects. The victim, Diane Whipple, was a beautiful, young, blonde woman, 110 pounds, height 5'3". So, and she lived with her longtime domestic partner, Sharon Smith. They're both basically the poster children for lesbians in that they were both attractive and feminine, which I think made it, in terms of, media consumption, even in San Francisco, a lot easier to sort of swallow. And, so there's even one book written about this case that's called Death of an Angel. That's sort of how easy it is to package the death of this young blonde woman. I didn't look, but I'm sure Nancy Grace had a lot to say about this back then.
Well, and there are a number of what you come to think of when you consume this genre as saleable aspects of the case, that these dogs attacked her and shredded her clothing completely. And there was no part of her that didn't have cuts and bite marks except the soles of her feet and the top of her head. And she was an athlete who presumably could have fought these dogs off if anyone could have. That there were all these things that made her even more sympathetic than just a standard victim about whom you didn't really know anything, except that she was attacked by these dogs.
Yeah.
And then you have the dog's owners. Please continue.
So the owners, Marjorie Knoller and her husband, Robert Knoll, were both attorneys who had recently closed up their external practice and started practicing out of their apartment, which, interestingly enough, the show sort of characterizes as the act of lunatics, which is a little upsetting to me and perhaps to you, because the implication was that they started to go wrong a little bit because they're working from home.
No, I'm comfortable with it. Absolutely true.
So
of course, I have not adopted someone my age.
So they've been doing pro bono work for various inmates, including this guy who is nicknamed Cornfed, and who they adopted when we watched the show. It's we thought he had some value, but what the show doesn't mention which is interesting, is that I guess the show mentions it sort of very discreetly. They say that they're interested in a three-way relationship. But if you just spend a little bit of time Googling this case, there's a book that came out in 2003, right around the same time as this case, that has all these documents, these letters that were confiscated in Paul Kornfeld Schneider's cell, lengthy erotic letters written to Schneider by Marjorie Knoller, other sort of things that were perhaps given to Knoll, erotic photos, a lot of erotic drawings, all given to this inmate, also a member of the Aryan Brotherhood, who was involved in a business outside prison training these dogs to be violent. These dogs that the attorneys had are dogs that they got through him, yet they claimed that these were somehow the two dogs that weren't involved in being trained how to kill, something that, you know, I think everyone in San Francisco was pretty dubious about, which is why eventually, with sort of the anger and the vigor of the crowds, the district attorney of San Francisco decided to file charges against them. Both Marjorie and Robert faced involuntary manslaughter charges and ownership of a mischievous animal that kills. Because, you know, that's how you define mischievous. I mean, this, you know, owner of a mischievous animal that kills. You look at the, they say mischievous animals that kills as you see these pictures of these dogs, which, and I say this as someone who loves dogs more than I do most people. These dogs are terrifying. I've seen these kind of dogs in real life. They are, were clearly made for one thing. And, and it's not to sit in your lap. But so eventually the couple were convicted. The interesting thing is that one of the owners, Marjorie Knoller, the woman who had the dogs with her at the time, was also convicted of second-degree murder. This was like sort of a contentious decision because that sort of thing, pushing for something like that, and what was, you know, pretty clearly the case of a dog that had escaped from its guardian. This was a very new thing for California, and I don't think any case like that's made it through since. But sort of the argument here was that she had a weapon, she was aware of it, and she was, you know, just being irresponsible. So Knoller was convicted, and that conviction was eventually appealed in San Francisco. The trial took place in Los Angeles. So when the appeal went down, they met with the judge. And Sarah, I was hoping that you could play the first clip I gave you. So it seems like a bad sign when a judge announces to a couple that's seeking an overturn of their conviction that nobody likes you. But that just being disliked, I think, was not enough for the judge, who since then has retired and now has a successful career in mediation. I'm told he's very good. He overturned Knoller's second-degree murder conviction while keeping up the mischievous animal. I'm sorry.
I know.
And the manslaughter verdicts for both of them. So they both went off to jail with a 4-year sentences got out in 2003 and 2004. And, you know, that it, per the show, is, you know, sort of the end of it. You see the credits and everything. And then our host returns to tell us that things are not what they were when they first broadcast the show in, it was broadcast in August of 2003. So the version that most of you will watch if you try to track it down on YouTube or something will have, what's his name, Curtis?
Yes, Bill Curtis. We'll have it linked in the show notes if anyone wants to watch.
Yeah. Bill Curtis will come back and he'll give you this update. And so you can see that he said, oh, well, you know, they could get as long as 15 years and, you know, you don't know what's happened since. But I can tell you because I live in the future. What happened is that they, you know, back and forth through appeal after appeal after appeal. Finally, in November 2015, she made it in front of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, AKA the all caps see you in court court. They declined to overturn it in February 2016. The conviction was upheld. She went back to jail and is serving her sentence at Valley State Prison for Women in Chowchilla. Whipple's partner Sharon Smith also sued them for $1.5 million in civil damages. She donated a large portion of that award to the college where Diane was a lacrosse coach to help support athletic programs.
Yeah, that really is quite a, just the whole thing is so sordid, like this, like, you know, polyamorous Aryan attack dog marriage gone horribly wrong.
So why didn't they talk more about that on the show? That's, you know, they, it was comparatively, the show was pretty dry.
Yeah. I mean, this was, you know, pretty typical of American justice that you're sort of getting like a 45 minute carefully packaged version that they can rerun at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And if a kid stumbles across it, it won't be too, they're not going to get a bunch of angry phone calls. So American
Justice. Still hope if any kid that stumbles across the, you know, the dog bitten to her neck spraying Marjorie with blood.
Oh, God. And then that, yeah. And then there's just the whole, like, Noller's account of, like, lying down on top of the victim and trying to protect her, like, which is why you had one bite on your finger. One mischievous little nip. But I thought it was okay, but I thought it's sort of like the canon on Extra Hot Grade, like one of the sort of standards for voting something in is, does it make you want to like watch more of them or read more about the case? So this is not a great 45 minutes, I wouldn't say. And again, we'll link it in the show notes. It's very standard, soothing American justice with Bill Curtis, but it did make me want to look up more about the case and see what had happened since then and just see. And then I disappeared down this dog bully breed Wikipedia hole.
Oh, Christ.
Probably not the best use of my time. But yeah, I thought, I don't know. I was glad to be like brought up to date on this story because I remembered it, but I had forgotten the details, especially the sordidity. Is there any other like ancillary material would you recommend at the books that you mentioned?
Well, the I really like Red Zone, which, yes, it's by Aphrodite Jones, who is a challenging figure. But I actually have it sitting by my bed right now because I found it on the street a couple of days ago and reread it. And I'm like, it's actually pretty solid. And it does go into, we can say, oh, these details are sorted or, you know, something like that. And they certainly are. But they also sort of represent, even though I understand, you know, oh, you know, you want this to be able to air this anytime, sort of some glossing over of certain facts by American justice that these books go into it full on. So I definitely recommend the Aphrodite Jones book. Like I said, it's called Red Zone. It's got tons of details on all the weird letters that they were exchanging with the inmate who provided them with the dogs, who we should mention were named Bane and Hera. Because if you want to have a dog that isn't a killer, name it Bane. It'll teach you a lot more about these dogs, which, you know, I don't think I knew anything about those dogs before then. It'll be, you know, and there are a lot of like quotes from people who, you know, since this case are people who through my job I've gotten to know and are all interesting people, like you know, Jim Hammer, the ADA on the case at the time, and, you know, Terrence Hallinan and a lot of other people who sort of worked on the case. She got good access to them and talked to a lot of people, and it's you know, it's an interesting narrative, and it's a fun, you know, sort of, it's a good beach read to or something like that, not to sort of not in any way suggesting that this tragedy is entertainment, but, you know, if you're not entertained, you're not going to read the book. So
it's a mischievous little beach read.
It's a mischievous book that just might kill you. So out of the two, out of the two books out there, that is the one that I would choose on this case. But really, if I were going to do anything, especially if I were just sitting on a computer, Jackson Vanderbeeken, the guy, the reporter that you hear usually taking sort of a tone of bemused disbelief as he discussed the case, has written, you know, covered the case so well. And keep in mind, this is back in the days when newspapers had time to send people down to LA and all this stuff. So if you go to the San Francisco Chronicle's website, which is sfgate.com, and just start searching those articles, you're going to find Jackson's coverage. Jackson, we've lost Jackson. We, print journalism, has lost Jackson to broadcast in recent years. He now is on NBC, but he's a great, very engaging, very pulpy kind of crime writer. He's not a dry guy at all. And so his coverage is a lot of fun and shows a sort of a mischievous wit in a lot of cases. So if you just wanted to get started and see if you're interested in the book, I would start by reading Jackson's coverage on SF Gate and go from there.
Very cool. Well, before we leave the listeners, where can we find your latest crime writing?
So you can find my crime writing for The Daily at sfist.com. And if you want to hear me opining on the fictional crimes currently going down in Monterey, California, I am covering Big Little Lies, a mystery, crimey show for Previously.tv. And coverage of every episode drops on Sunday evenings.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much for being with us. And for those of you who have some ideas about what we should be covering in the future, whether it's present day crime shows or the vintage crime shows of yesteryear, LA City of Demons, Desperate Stranger. I'm sure there's a movie called that, but I actually meant The Deliberate Stranger. Whatever you like, you can email me, sarah@previously.tv, or you can tweet at this podcast at Blotter Presents. Eve, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.